International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Brownfield Sports, Strickland Insurance, and Field of Greens.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to this program Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He also is clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois in the med school. And for a long time, longer than he's been clinical assistant professor, he's been stopping by here on this program, always on a Thursday, once a month, to talk about children's health as a resource for you. We've talked about a lot of different things over the years, and things that have to do with wellness and illness and development and behavior, all the kinds of things that you could imagine you'd talk about with a pediatrician. We've done that here on the program, and so it's wide open. Whatever's on your mind, if you have a concern, you have a question, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Well, good morning. It's good to be back.
Good to have you here. Well, I think we already have somebody ready to go, so we'll put our topics of conversation on hold for a little bit, and we'll go here to the caller. And this listener is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My question is about rickets. My son is a baby, and he's being told, I'm being told to give him some vitamin D drops to counter any rickets problems. And I have no idea. I mean, I think it's something to do with bone development or something like that, but I guess it's been a long ago disease or something. So if you could talk about what that is and how to manage that for my son.
Yeah, I get rickets is we don't see very often anymore. Rickets has to do with vitamin D deficiency and parathormone and calcium intake, and all these things are kind of interrelated. Probably most commonly we'll see rickets in, it's been reported recently in totally breastfed babies.
And totally breastfed babies.
Totally breastfed babies.
Okay, he gets a little bit of formula supplement, not much.
Okay. And how old is he?
6 months.
Okay. Is he getting any solid foods yet?
No, he doesn't want it.
Probably a vitamin D supplement is in controlled doses is not a problem. It would probably be advisable. Vitamin D or rickets is seen in totally breastfed babies. Especially in the winter months, because we talk about sunshine vitamin D. And yeah, when we're exposed to sun, our skin will make vitamin D for us.
Okay.
So it's more common it gets to be more common in the winter when we see less sun.
Okay.
And it's more common in dark-skinned individuals.
Oh.
Because they will absorb less sun through their skin and make less vitamin D. So a little bit of extra vitamin D won't be harmful at all.
Okay, and so basically because of the lack of sun is why they get the rickets, or it's just lack of vitamin D?
Well, it's lack of vitamin D, but vitamin D, again, we will make vitamin D, but we need sun exposure to make vitamin D.
Okay.
So if you put in a tanning booth, I suppose, in your home and get tanned that way, you'll make adequate vitamin D. But, yeah, that's the concern. It's been reported in some totally breastfed babies, mainly in darkly pigmented mothers.
Okay.
It's not seen that often. I think
they had it like a special on it. I think it was on CBS or NBC, one of those news stations, and they just kind of mentioned it. But I was not really sure on what it really is.
Yeah, it's a lack of vitamin D, and it affects the bones.
Okay. What does it look like?
It won't look like anything.
Oh.
Outwardly, it won't look like anything. You can diagnose it by measuring vitamin D levels. You can diagnose it by measuring calcium and phosphorus.
Oh.
X-rays will show it in the bones later, you know, as it progresses.
Okay.
Vitamin D, I should say, needs to be controlled. Yeah, it needs to be given. You don't want to give too much vitamin D.
Oh.
If you give too much vitamin D, you can turn the kidneys to calcium.
Oh, no.
But this vitamin D is being... There's a fairly large difference between... There's a good safety difference between too much and too little.
They tell me just a dropper full a day?
Yes.
Is that would be enough?
Probably one of the baby vitamins, Triviflor, Tribisol, or one of those. Yeah.
Right. And that's not going to overdo it.
No, not at all.
Now, once he starts eating cereal and stuff, does that change then? You don't have to do the dropper full anymore?
Or yeah,
should I check with the pediatrician?
You won't need to do that, or once he goes on to, say, cow's milk, because cow's milk is supplemented with vitamin D.
Okay, so that would take care of that. Okay, great.
But yeah, once he gets into more of it, and he's 6 months old, so within the next 3 months, he'll probably be getting onto a more solid food diet.
Yeah.
And then the D supplements or vitamin D deficiency won't be a worry anymore.
Great. Okay, wonderful. Thanks for answering my questions.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Very good. Thank you for the call. I think I recently, and in fact, one of the last times that Dr. Troopin, our OBGYN here, was on the program, he talked a little bit about I guess there's some concern that there may overall in the population be something of a vitamin D deficiency. And that it partly has to do with the fact that we're being told to stay out of the sun and people are wearing sunscreens and that we're not perhaps getting quite as much absorbing it through our skin the way that we used to. And just for that reason, I'm sure that there are a lot of things that are supplemented with vitamin D. It's in milk because it's important that you have some vitamin D with your calcium and some weight-bearing exercise to get that calcium taken up in your body. So, and you can always, you know, go and take an off-the-shelf supplement as long as you don't overdo it.
But yeah.
I guess there is some reason to be concerned that all of us, we make sure that we get what's recommended.
Yeah, for us seniors, the Centrum Silver, multiple vitamin once a day. Generally, again, in children, we do not, you know, in infants, you take them for what they're feeding and that sort of thing. Generally, again, for the normal child who's offered a normal diet, we do not recommend vitamin supplementations because they have adequate vitamins of every sort in their diet. And again, milk is fortified with vitamin D, so it's probably irrespective of, sunlight's probably not a significant factor there. Again, most of these most of the vitamin D deficient rickets reported in infants are breastfeeding moms, very often darkly pigmented. So the African Americans don't tend to absorb sun through their skin as well because of the dark pigmentation, so they don't make as much vitamin D. And the other group of people we're concerned about is the Muslim women who stay covered. So they have very little skin exposed to the sun. And so they're not making much vitamin D. So, again, supplementation would be important in those, in everybody, but those two we look at in particular.
Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us once a month on the show to talk about children's health. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, we're just about getting into the cold and flu season. So far, I guess we haven't seen a lot of flu, but we expect that we will. And just your regular old cold is something that we all sort of have to deal with. And it's probably a good idea to, once again, do a little review, particularly for people who are concerned that because of the shortage of flu vaccine, everybody is not going to be able to get a shot. We hope that people in the high-risk categories do. But a lot of the rest of us are just going to have to cross our fingers and do everything we can to try to stay healthy. So maybe, again, we should review those easy things that everybody can do to try to make it through the winter without getting sick.
So, wash your hands.
Number one, wash your hands.
Wash
number
your
two,
hands again.
Wash, number three,
sneeze
wash
into sneeze into a Kleenex. Or the other thing that's suggested by the CDC that I've never thought about that makes a lot of sense, when you cough into your upper sleeve. Just put your arm in front of your face and cough into your upper sleeve, and then you don't have to worry about it transmitting to your hands. And then you don't have to worry about, because you can't, you know, wash your hands. That's easy, but it's often, you know, you're not near a water source, so you can't wash your hands all the time. The alcohol, the disinfectant towelettes you can you can wipe your hands with, they're quite helpful. But and again, probably what we ought to get away from in this country is handshaking. It's just, it's, you know, you get out, you get done with church service, and everybody goes and shakes the minister's hand. So he passes on whatever he's got in his hands to your hands, and shaking hands with 500 people, and all these people have changed, have exchanged germs, and you know, it's probably, maybe we ought to bow, or you know, lay hands on each other's shoulders, or grasp forearms, or something like that, because handshaking probably is just basically a unhygienic way of greeting people.
We should set up a hand-washing station. We should have the minister wash everybody's hands on the way out.
That's right. Or we should learn from the Japanese and just a tactful, polite bow, bow and smile and that. But yeah, and you know, again, the flu vaccine is short, but we don't know if we're going to have flu this year anyway. So I think it's a national inconvenience, not a national reason for terror. And it's kind of fallen out of the news media recently anyway, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing is ear infections. This is cold season. This is upper respiratory season. Ear infections often complicate colds and upper respiratory infections. And recently, sort of a new paradigm treatment has come out. Well, actually, I guess it's not new. We've known for a long time that most ear infections, the bacteria that cause them, Moraxella catarrhalis and some others, are sort of like bacterial lemmings. They last for a day or two or three, and then they just sort of die all by themselves, and the ear infection goes away. And a lot of European countries have, for the longest time, if the, you know, the child's complaining of some ear discomfort, but they're not sick, they're over age two, they don't have a fever and that sort of stuff, maybe we can just watch them for a day or two or three, and the ear infection will go away all by itself, because even if we put them on antibiotics, they're still going to be in pain for a day or two or three anyway. So the antibiotics probably don't shorten the course of the illness in most of the kids with ear infections, certainly if they're under two. And even if they're older and they're in extreme pain and they've got fever and that sort of thing, maybe it's a reason for an antibiotic. So, yeah, folks, don't demand an antibiotic from your doctor for colds and bronchitis and maybe even ear infections, because a lot of these are viral illnesses, or they're, in the case of an ear infection, in the case of a cold, they're almost always viral. In the case of bronchitis in a normal host, they're always viral. They do not need an antibiotic. So do not give an antibiotic. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Do not spend $200 for an antibiotic. And just, yeah, so if your doctor says, gee, I don't think, you know, I think we ought to watch your child. Your doctor is not being a therapeutic nihilist. Your doctor is practicing good medicine, and maybe go along with it, or I would go along with it and not demand antibiotics. And part of the concern is, you know, these antibiotics aren't helping these kids. They don't need them. Part of the concern is these antibiotics, $200, well, they're not quite that much, but some of them are quite expensive. The broad spec, and then we worry about bacterial resistant to antibiotics, and the broader spectrum of the antibiotic. That broad spectrum means that it covers a whole, penicillin covers a few bacteria. It's a so-called narrow spectrum antibiotic. Broad spectrum antibiotics cause a lot of bacteria. Well, you know what? Bacteria aren't stupid. When one figures out how to not respond to an antibiotic, it passes a plasmid, which is a bacterial virus, onto the other bacteria that says, hey, this is how I did it. This is how you can do it, too. So all of a sudden, you've got a bigger and bigger, larger and larger population of bacteria that say, oh, that antibiotic, well, that's okay. It doesn't bother me anymore. So, yeah, we're worried about overuse of antibiotics and causing bacterial resistance, and we'll run out of antibiotics. And we have, in, like, staph, aureus, is not responding to a lot of antibiotics, and there's a lot of other bugs. Some of the gram-negatives are really, it's hard to find an antibiotic to treat them now. So, yeah, I think we want to use antibiotics. We've got them. We want to use them when we should use them, but we don't want to use them when we shouldn't use them to preserve their efficacy.
All right. We have somebody else here with a question. Let's talk with them in Champaign, line one.
Hello?
Yes.
I just have a question about acne, because my daughter has had acne from the age of 9, and now she's 15, and we've tried all the over-the-counters. We've tried a lot of dermatological creams and lotions. She's done things with antibiotics, speaking about antibiotics, and nothing ever really seems to give her a clear reflection. And I just wondered if I should just give up and say, okay, she's got acne, that's it, and just see it through, or if we, I wondered your opinion about that other drug that really
Accutane.
Yes, what your opinion was about that, because I got some information on it, and it was very intimidating, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank
you. Okay. Acne is, what does it have to do with? It has to do with age, certainly, with adolescence, certainly. At age 9 probably isn't too early. I presume your daughter, again, was starting into puberty at that time, so she was in adolescence. And so it has something to do with adolescence. It has something to do with infections of the sebaceous glands of the skin. And it disappears with age. We do tend to outgrow it as we approach physiologic maturity and skin maturity, and acne tends to go away. So do we really care about acne? Well, yes and no. We care about acne if it appears that it's going to cause some scarring of the skin, because most minor acne, well, yeah, it comes along at times. It tends to come along at times of stress, so it comes along at test time, and it comes along at prom time and that sort of thing. And so it's cosmetically, they don't like it. And adolescents tend to be a little bit very concerned about their appearance anyway, which is part of adolescence, which is okay. But if they're going to scar, or if we think they're going to scar, I think that's the time when you pull out all the stops. And if nothing's working and it looks like the skin is going to scar, I think that's the time when Accutane should come out. Accutane should be used only in the hands of a dermatologist, and we need assurance that the patient will not get pregnant while they're on Accutane, because if they're on Accutane, the fetus is almost assuredly going to be severely deformed, usually the central nervous system, and yes, they're going to have severe central brain problems, and so we want to make sure that these girls don't get pregnant while they're on Accutane. So often when they're on Accutane, they'll do pregnancy tests once a month, or insist that they be on birth control pills or something like that, because you just really don't want to get these girls pregnant. But it works very well, and it's usually given for a relatively short period of time, 3 months or so. And that seems to do the job, seems to cure it. So I think if your daughter has severe cystic acne, the big giant pimples, those are the ones that, as they heal, tend to pucker down and scar. Accutane, consultation with a dermatologist and consideration and discussion about Accutane is certainly in order.
As I recall, one of the potential complications of Accutane is it may cause some liver problems.
Yeah.
Is that right? So also, I think one of the things that they do for people who are on this course of treatment is periodically they do check of liver function to make sure that the liver's okay.
But again, the duration of treatment is only about 3 months, so you don't have to – it needs to be checked, but it's generally not – it's a possibility, whereas the toxic effects on the fetus are a guarantee.
That's really bad. Yes. So, again, your sort of feeling is if you have a really serious, persistent case of acne, and it's really making the young person really unhappy, that you think that that's a pretty good way to go, and the possibility of some bad outcome is
if it's going to scar the skin.
Yeah. Okay.
The superficial blemishes and the superficial pimples and that sort of stuff, they don't do anything. The teenagers don't like it, but they don't do anything permanent to the skin. Yeah. My understanding also is that I think all teenagers in this country, they all get braces and they all go to the dermatologist for their acne. Where my understanding is in Europe, acne is part of growing up, and it's accepted, and They don't spend near as much money on acne treatments as we do in the United States. But again, I will still go back to if they've got deep cystic acne that's likely to scar the skin, do go to a dermatologist, and he or she may very well suggest Accutane.
And it's, and that is it is a, something that's only a prescription.
Yes.
Prescription only
yes.
product.
And it's a vitamin A congener.
It's an oral medication.
It's an oral medication.
It's not something you put on the skin.
Yeah, it's not something you rub on the skin.
Okay. Well, our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us monthly, always on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour. And for a long, long time now, we've been doing these shows on a regular basis so that you will have the opportunity to call in and ask questions about children's health. 333-9455. That's the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, and your calls are certainly welcome. We're just about at the midpoint of the show. Just to go back for a second, we were talking about ear infection, and you're talking about the fact that maybe we reach too quickly for the antibiotic and that it's possible, and in some cases you might just let it take care of itself, and that maybe in a couple of days it will. For symptom reduction, though, I mean, if you've got a child that's really unhappy, besides maybe giving them a appropriate dose of Tylenol or something like that, is there anything else that you can do?
Generally we'll use one of the over-the-counter analgesics, the Tylenol, the acetaminophen, the ibuprofen, those sorts of things. There's some topical lidocaine drops that you can put in the ears. I was never terribly impressed with those things. They gave relief, but it was just was so brief that I'm not sure it was worthwhile. And again, I think, you know, we're not talking that no ear infection gets antibiotics. If it's really an acutely inflamed, bulgy ear, and the child's in significant pain, maybe has a fever, those kids, we still say, they get antibiotics. We're not talking about treating no ear infections with antibiotics. We're just saying, I think what we're saying basically is, doctor, make sure that you've got the diagnosis right. Make sure that it is an acute, probable bacterial infection, that you've seen the eardrum, that you've seen that it's bulgy, that you've seen that it's fiery red, that you've seen that all the landmarks are gone. Maybe you've done a pneumatic otoscopy and you know the eardrum doesn't move. And, if there's just a little fluid behind it, or it's just a little distorted or a little pink, that's not an acute otitis media with effusion. That's not an ear problem that gets an antibiotic. The other thing that's often brought up is this ear infection going to interfere with my child's hearing? And the answer to that is yes. During the acute ear infection, and for a few weeks possibly afterwards, while there's still some effusion, some fluid in that ear, their hearing's not going to be quite right. But the long-term effect of this is that there's no effect on the ears. That by age 5, kids have outgrown the tendency toward ear infections. Probably the mid-face has grown and the eustachian tubes have gone to its proper angle. And we really rarely see ear infections anymore at that age. And hearing has returned to normal. In these kids who've had frequent ear infections, hearing's returned to normal and speech is normal.
Because that's what worries a lot of people, that it may have caused some problems for language acquisition. Yeah. If you can't, because part of how it is we learn to speak is by listening to the sounds that other people make. And if something's wrong with your hearing and you can't hear that, then you're going to maybe have a tough time picking up. But it sounds as if you're saying that's
certainly true in the kids who've got congenital deafness for whatever reason. But in the kids with recurrent ear infections, that's rarely true. They do fine.
When you do it, when you're at the doctor and they're just sort of checking you over and they have this little thing that they stick in your ear and you'd look in there, what is it that you're looking at, or what is it that you can see? I mean, I would guess if there was inflammation or something, you know, there might be things that you could actually see. Are there a lot of things, potential problems that with just that little amplification by being able to look in there that you can see?
Yes. Oh, yes. That's the way to generally the way to diagnose middle ear disease. The eardrum itself is round, and it's supposed to be pearly gray in normal situation. And I like to say pearly gray. Okay, what's pearly gray? I don't know. It looks, the best way I can describe it, it looks like a round piece of wax paper. It has that similar color. And the short, and then there's three little bones that connect the eardrum to the middle ear, and they transmit the sound mechanically that way. And one of these little bones sticks out, so it pokes out a little bit. And at the bottom, you see the so-called, and normally, in a normal condition, at the bottom, you see where it's pulled in, you see this little light reflex, a little triangle of white light reflecting back to you. And that's the normal situation. And with, yeah, if there's any pathology in the middle ear, particularly infections, all this is distorted. The eardrum will, the middle ear is full of pus and bacteria and inflammatory cells, so there's a lot of inflammation. So the eardrum, so the middle ear gets filled and the eardrum gets pushed out at you. So we describe that as bulging, and it's bright red. It's inflamed, it's infected, it's kind of like a boil, if you will. So it's bright red, and you lose all the light reflex is gone, and the short process where it pokes out is gone because the whole eardrum's poked out at you. You can see, certainly you can see perforations if there happens to be a perforation there. Sometimes cholesteatomas, which are, oh gosh, how do I describe those now that I've opened my mouth and got myself into trouble? Cholesteatoma is, it's where, it's probably invagination of epithelial cells from the eardrum. They grow in there. It's very rare. I think I've seen two or three of them in my career. But you can sometimes see those, although they can be a little bit hard to see sometimes. We can't see the bones too much. We can see the short process of the bones sticking out, but we can't see how the bones are working in there. But we can, yeah, particularly for infections, that's the way to go. And then we can do pneumatic otoscopy, and you may have seen this in your child where there's a little insufflator, a little bulb attached to the otoscope, the flashlight the doctor's using to look at the ears, and he's blowing a little air in there. Because in normal circumstance, you can blow that eardrum a little bit because that's the way we hear sound waves come in and
vibrates back.
Bang on the eardrum. Yeah. And that makes the bones move and transfers it to the inner ear. They'll do pneumograms sometimes where it's like pneumatic otoscopy, except the machine does it. It puts a little positive pressure, a little negative pressure in the ear, and it gives a tracing of how the eardrum's moving.
Okay. Our guest this morning, Dr. Robert Bocek. This is our monthly show on children's health. He's a pediatrician. He's also clinical assistant professor at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And monthly, on a Thursday, he's here. We talk about children's health and pediatrics. So any of the kinds of things that you can imagine talking about with a pediatrician, you can do here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have caller in Charleston on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. This is historically a PEDS question, and probably all I need is a yes or no. I was born with congenital hearing loss.
Okay.
Due to the hardening of the stirrup, I think.
Okay.
And I had three operations altogether and revisited one. And I can hear with a hearing aid, okay, and I'm an old man now, but this started before I were born from my grandmother, I think. And my question is, has there been any upgrade of the statendectomy or some detection where my only early warning was tinnitus, and then it gradually got worse by the time I was 30. Then my hearing loss, and I was too proud to wear a hearing aid or to go and get some help until evidently some nerve damage. But anyway, I just wondered if there was any upgrade in that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You know, I guess I can't answer if there's an upgrade in the surgical repair of the. Yeah, there's sometimes otosclerosis, or the three little bones in the middle ear, either fused together or one may be absent or all kinds of things that way. So sound hits the eardrum, but it doesn't get transmitted through the acicular chain through these three little bones, the hammer, the anvil, the stirrup, malleus, incus, and stapes. So these people are at a hearing deficit. And, yeah, there's surgical correction. If there's been change in the surgical correction, I'm not in a position to tell you to state that. The interesting thing is in most states now, if not all states, they're doing hearing screening in the newborn period. There's several methods that'll do it. It's not perfect hearing screening, but it's going to pick up certainly the kids with the deeper hearing loss, the more profound hearing loss. It's not going to pick up kids who have normal hearing at birth and then for whatever reason lose their hearing later on. So, yeah, but it's going to pick up the congenital, mainly the congenital nerve deaf kids. Very often it's hereditary, but not always, or it can be a new mutation. So we're going to pick up the kids with hearing loss sooner. And hopefully we can get them into, yeah, we can do what we need to. We can get them a hearing aid. We can get them into special rehab-type programs. They're doing some work with cochlear implants. I just heard a talk recently by a professor who works at Beckman Institute who's working on a focused hearing aid. The problem with the hearing aids now is what they are is general amplification. So they amplify everything. They don't help us localize anything. And so people with hearing aids have a lot of trouble in noisy environments because it will amplify my voice if I'm talking to you in a restaurant, but it amplifies the dishes crackling together and conversations at the other table. So, yeah, this is hard for us with normal hearing. This is even harder for people with hearing deficits who have a hearing aid because it amplifies non-selectively everything. So they are working on a new hearing aid that will sort of help normalize hearing instead of just amplifying sounds. It was quite an interesting presentation. And so there is hope for people with hearing aids that the hearing aids, the technology will improve. And it will function more like a normal ear and help us localize sounds and help us focus on people we want to listen to and sort of we can sort of disregard the background noise.
All right. Let's talk with someone else in Savoy. Line one.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I had a question. It's kind of a sports medicine question. My daughter plays basketball, and for the last couple of years, she continues to complain about nagging muscle soreness in the thigh. Really, it's pretty much one leg. we, you know, use ice and sometimes wrap it and so forth. I was just wondering if there's any type of anything else we could be doing or looking for.
Has she been evaluated by a physician or a trainer?
No.
You know, I think that might be a good idea because it might be something as simple as maybe she needs a different kind of shoe. Maybe she's got a little pest planes, a little flat foot on that side, and a little arch support or something, or a little orthotic will put her foot into better alignment, and the stresses down from the hip down through the knee down to the foot will be better aligned and might be something as simple as that. Or maybe she needs some special exercise. Maybe that one leg is a little weaker than the other. And the other thing is talk to the coach. Maybe he's noticed something about her way she shoots or something like that that could help things out too. But I think I would start with a trainer or a sports medicine doctor and see if, you know, maybe just a little different kind of maybe a different kind of tennis shoe will give her better arch support and put the weight bearing, the stress on that leg in a little, yeah, remove the stress on that leg and just make life a whole lot more pleasant. Where is her pain exactly?
It's in that upper thigh, that thigh muscle, you know, above the knee.
Okay.
Knee and the hip.
The quads, the big, yeah.
Yeah, the big one.
The big muscle. Yeah, it could be, although usually foot problems present with knee pain, but it could be something as simple as, yeah.
Okay. Well,
a different,
thank you, Doc.
Different shoe.
Thank you very much.
You're all welcome. Right.
Other questions, again, are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It's our monthly show on children's health. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. Just going back again to the ear infection deal, I remember many years ago when we first started doing this and we talked about ear infections, we talked a lot about tubes,
yeah,
inserting tubes in the ear. Is that still something that is done?
It's still done. I think it's done with less frequency. Because we now know that, leave the fluid. I think what they're still saying is if the fluid persists for longer than 3 months, consider tube placement. But fluid that's there for less than 3 months, just leave it alone because most of the time it's going to go away by itself. And again, the long-term repercussions are normal hearing and normal speech.
Okay. So that's that seems like a long time to me, though. I mean, 3 months. I would think, particularly if my child was really uncomfortable, a month might seem like a long time.
Fluid in the ears, though, an acute infection hurts. Fluid in the ears usually doesn't cause pain. Uh-huh. It causes, you get that feeling like, you've been in the swimming pool and got water in your ear. That's the, You get that feeling like you just want to pop that ear. You want to get the water out of there, and you wish, that you didn't feel that little bit of pressure. But it really won't, it's really not painful, and the kids aren't awake at night crying and that sort of thing. They just don't hear very well out of that ear, and they've got this, Mom, will you do something to get the water out of my ear?
Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. Bloomington, Illinois, next in line. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I have a six-month-old son. Between the age 2 and 4 months, he developed a lump in his arch in the foot, and my pediatrician doesn't think it's something really maybe dangerous, but I just wanted to know your opinion. How often does it happen, in the children that age, and should I be concerned and, pursue the, choose a different doctor and perhaps some medical treatment?
What is this? What do you mean by a lump?
Well, it's like a fat tissue,
Okay.
Like an arch.
Yeah. Kids have fat feet. Yeah, infants have fat feet, not
fat
flat
feet.
Feet.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And, you won't see much of an arch there, and probably your pediatrician's right.
Okay.
That it's just a fat foot, but it does look much different than the other foot.
It's only on the right side, and it's kind of, if you touch it, you can feel the lump. But I was concerned that if you start walking, do we need to have, a special shoes, or is it going to go away, or...
Now, you're feeling a lump there that's not soft like fatty tissue. It's not soft like if you pinch his forearm gently.
No, it's kind of quite noticeable, It's a size maybe of their big bean.
Okay.
If you feel it there.
And it feels like a bean.
Yeah.
I think maybe I'd go to an orthopedic surgeon because that's infants do have fat feet with no arch, but you really shouldn't feel anything there. And the feet generally look, the left looks like the right. And usually if you feel this fat foot, it just feels like fatty tissue there, soft fatty tissue there. And if you're feeling a lump, I think I would pursue that.
Okay. So you think we need to do like x-rays and just to go further into the...
Possibly, yeah. Uh-huh. If you go to an orthopedic surgeon, the orthopods can't think without an x-ray, which is okay. And that's the only way to see. But if you're feeling kind of a hard lump there, I don't know what that is. I've never seen that in a baby's foot, but it should not be there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see here. We'll go to our line number two next. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I have a question for Dr. Bocek. It's really a combination question and concern. It was prompted by the caller about the sports medicine type question.
Mm-hmm.
And I've observed that just about every sports banquet that we go to, the coaches invariably at the end of the season will give words of praise to the athlete that has still competed when they're in pain, when they've twisted an ankle and they still go on. And as a parent, it always sort of bothers me thinking somehow I feel like we're sending the wrong message to kids. Like if you're really hurt, the noble thing to do is to keep going on. And I'm wondering, am I being neurotic or what's your reaction to this?
No, you know what? I think you're absolutely right. Well, you know, again, if this child has been to a sports medicine physician or a trainer says it's okay to play on that injury, then I suppose it is. But I'm with you. If the body's saying, ouch, I think the ouch translates into don't do it and give it a rest, let it heal, and then go back and condition first, get back into shape if you've laid off the sport for a while, get toned back up again so you don't re-injure, and then get back to play. And yeah, I don't think there should be a reward for being stupid. You know?
I know, but you know, it really puts the kids in a real bind.
Yeah.
Because the coaches are saying, well, either A, they ignore it because the kids don't really want to say if they're hurting, because I think there's this image that if you're hurt, that's
you're a
not
wimp.
Okay,
yeah.
You're a wimp. Or if you're hurt and you won't go on, there's something wrong. So it's really a bind. Like the parents end up, you know, knowing what's going on when the kids come home and they're in agony.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting bind, and I just see this go on and on. But I have yet to be at one sports banquet where there hasn't been words of praise for someone that keeps going in the middle of the pain. And
yeah.
Anyway, I don't know what you can do about it.
And I think, you know, again, sometimes that's okay. If it's been evaluated by somebody who should know and says, hey, tape it up and go, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, you don't want to convert a simple sprain into a tendinous avulsion.
Right.
You know, you just, and if the body's saying, ouch, that hurts, don't do it, I think it'd be best to listen to the body and don't do it or seek help and have it evaluated to make sure that it is safe to go ahead and play on it. And, you know, I know the coach's position. The coach wants to win.
Right.
And the coach doesn't, and who gets injured? It's the one who plays the most, their best players. They're the ones that are going to have the overuse injuries and that. And you say, okay, coach, I know, your job is to win, but okay, I'm a mother. My job is to make sure that my child grows and,
Well, or, you know, or when they get to be 30 or 35, they don't have these long-term injuries that start showing up, you know.
Because the other award I hate that the schools give is the perfect attendance award. You know, this kid gets an award because he or she went to school with 102 fever and the flu and was spewing virus all over the place and got the rest of the class sick, but she still went to school. And you say, no, that's not it. Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Yes, this is concerning the ear. You were talking about the ear. This doesn't really have to do with kids or anything, but last year, a friend of mine, I believe it's called ear candling. Do you know about that?
Mm.
It's a kind of holistic way of taking the wax out of your ear, that there's this, it's like a cone-shaped tube. And one end, the small end, is about between 1/8 and 1/4 inch in diameter. And then it flares out to maybe an inch in diameter. And you put the short end in your ear, and you set the other end on fire. And, of course, you're laying on your side, but that draws all the wax out.
Yeah,
I don't know if there's any adverse. I was just curious as whether you know of any really adverse practice matter.
Yeah, I think maybe an adult. Certainly, cerumen wax has a low melting point, so if you warm it up, it'll become runny and you'll get the plug out. And I think maybe there's other, I think, safer ways to get the wax plug out. There's different solutions made to soften the cerumen. And I guess the concern I have is if the end point is 1 millimeter, you don't want to push it in too far and perforate the eardrum. The other thing is there's fire there. You sure don't want to burn the ear, and I think maybe an adult, you know, the adult will feel the, is doing it himself, him or herself will feel the heat and say, you know, I think it's time to pull this thing out of the ear, but I'm kind of worried about a child who
right.
is probably going to protest having the thing put in his ear in the first place. And are you, yeah, you're going to tell the difference between his protestation that something's being put in his ear or that his ear's on fire.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I think there's other safer ways to get cerumen out of the ear.
Yeah.
And the major thing to keep cerumen from accumulating in your ear is don't put Q-tips in your ears.
Right, right.
Or the cotton swabs in your ears, because that tends to pack it back in there.
But, okay, this woman did it once on me last year, and it made a world of difference.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going, wow, I'd never heard of it before in my life.
Because we've talked about hearing loss from fluid in the middle ear. We've talked about hearing loss from the acicular chain, the three little bones being fused and not being able to move. Well, another way we get hearing loss is if sound waves can't get through the eardrum because there's something obstructing the ear canal, like cerumen, or occasionally we find a bean or a part of a crayon or something like that in children. And the physical examination, too, will show if there's an obstruction of the ear canal.
Okay.
But certainly we want a clean ear canal, or a reasonably clean ear canal. Now, do we want all the cerumen out of your ear? No. It's not there for nothing. It does provide a barrier on the skin that keeps the ear canal healthy and keeps it from getting infected and that sort of thing. So, you know, yeah, cerumen was put there for a purpose. A little bit of cerumen is a good thing to have. A little bit of earwax is a good thing to have.
Okay, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
And when your mother says don't put beans in your ears,
pay
attention. Line one is somebody here on cell phone. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
I have had a question that I've been wondering about for a long time. My wife is from South America, and when we talk about the size of babies here in the U.S., they seem huge to her. And then when I go down there and talk about the babies there, they seem very tiny in terms of weight and size. And even if you look at the children as they grow up, they seem to be kind of different. And I was wondering if you understood that, because, you know, I might go live there someday. I wonder if it was a nutritional problem or if it was something else.
You're right. It's probably nutrition. For the most part, it's nutrition and general health of the mother.
Okay, because when you talk to the doctors down there, they seem to have a different idea of what is normal and kind of average in terms of weight gain and things like that. You think it's just a nutritional?
It may be nutrition. And the other thing we need to factor in there is certainly we know that Asian babies are smaller than American babies. So we need to factor race in there and basic genetic background that way too. So the birth weight of a baby has a whole lot of factors that feed into it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right,
you're welcome.
So in is there some straight line kind of relationship between the birth weight and the length of the baby and adult weight and height?
Approximate only. Yeah, the general rule is a baby will triple their birth weight by the end of 3 or 4 months or double their birth weight by the end of 3 or 4 months and triple it by the end of a year. And that's what we follow along. But then if we're looking at adult height, this baby doubled at 4 months, tripled at a year of age. That's cool. That's great. This baby's being taken care of well, and everything seems to be going fine. But then when we say, okay, this one-year-old has successfully tripled birth weight, what's he or she going to – how tall is he or she going to be when they're finished growth? Then you ignore all that stuff, and you look at the parents, and you say, okay, what's mom's height, adult height? What's dad's adult height? And you plug it into this formula, and you say, that's what I guess – yeah.
Tall people have tall kids. Short people have short kids.
It
just sort of, yeah. Okay. We see. Get at least one more caller here. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to upset the other caller, but my understanding is that this earwax candling thing is a total hoax, because the wax that they end up pulling out is actually the wax from the candle that they just melted into your ear.
Okay.
Now, whether that pulls some of the the own ear wax out or not, but they pull 2 or 3 inches of wax and say, this came out of your ear.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I've never seen this. And,
I've even heard that the people that actually do it don't always know that it's a hoax because of the way that it's worked.
Okay.
It's not obvious to the person that's even doing it that what they're pulling out is candle wax. Anyway, I just thought I'd tell them that. And
thank you.
You can look that up on the internet, I think.
Because you can melt. I mean, the cerumen has a low melting point, but you still got to get the heat close to the ear, which scares me having a lit wick in your ear. You know, it just doesn't strike me
as a new age thing, and it's just totally bogus, is what I've heard.
Yeah. There's much safer.
I'll let you go.
Okay, thank you. There's much safer, more effective. There's drops that you can put in there. Hydrogen peroxide, plain old hydrogen peroxide will work to take the wax out.
How would you even know if you had a problem?
Usually the doctor will tell you because he can't see your eardrum because there's wax in the way. Or you may notice that all of a sudden, I don't hear. You know, one ear, the hearing just sort of, you'll have to speak louder. There's a bean in my ear. Yeah, all of a sudden the hearing goes, and chances are, especially if you're using Q-tips, chances are you put the cerumen back in there and plugged up the whole ear canal. And
so, you know, here's, again, one of those things, you know, you say don't put the Q-tips in your ear. I think actually on the package of the Q-tips it says the same thing. And then people are going to say, well, what's the point? What am I supposed to do with it if I'm not putting it in my ear?
The point is, don't buy them. they have very little use. You know, they aren't even long and stiff enough to get a throat culture to use them for a throat swab. So the answer is, yeah.
Your advice is don't stick them into that hole there.
Yeah.
Don't put them into the ear.
But anything smaller than your elbow, you're not supposed to put in your ear. Try and put your elbow in your ear.
It covers quite a lot of ground.
Try and even get your elbow near your ear, folks. It can't be done.
All right. Anything else you might like to leave folks here with as we're in our last minute or two?
Just enjoy your children. Enjoy life. The world is good. And have a happy Thanksgiving.
All right. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at U of I Med School Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, he is on this very program. On a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, we talk about children's health. And we'll be back, I guess that would be December, and you'll be back. And it'll be almost Christmas. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Today's broadcast also made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers